Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We've reached a crossroad in the history of the U.S. and Iraq. On one road, Iraqis dodging bullets and chased by violence, with a complete lack of faith in their own government.
I don't feel that we should waste another dollar on Iraq. Let the Iraqi people take care of themselves.
On the other road, American veterans disillusioned and angry over hopes dashed and plans gone awry, reluctant to get involved with Iraq once again. This hour, the question of what now? Where does the responsibility lie for protecting, governing, can we even say liberating the people of Iraq?
Hi, this is Giff from San Francisco. While we have total responsibility for toppling the Saddam Hussein regime, we have no appropriate military response to the current situation in Iraq. We need to stay far away and only provide humanitarian aid as requested or appropriate. If we go back in to Iraq with guns blazing, we will have learned absolutely nothing from the last 11 years.
Please join this conversation at 877-8MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org. 11 years since the invasion of Iraq, and an outcome suddenly looms that no one wanted, and that now it appears no one can prevent. This hour, people on the ground in Iraq speak, and veterans home from a war remember their mission from so long ago. We begin with a couple of important facts on the ground right now. A battle is raging between ISIS forces and government forces at an oil facility that controls a quarter of Iraq's refining capacity, Beji, the largest such facility in the country. Meanwhile, a call for U.S. airstrikes from Iraqi President Nouri al-Maliki has gone unanswered at this point from Washington. Various reports from Pentagon officials say targeting is too difficult right now without killing civilians, or that the political situation is too uncertain, a possibly veiled suggestion that the U.S. might rather have Maliki out of the way before intervening. The Saudis have expressed a clear preference that the Shiite leader Maliki be replaced in Baghdad. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is in the capital in Washington. Todd, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. Good to be with you.
So who have you been talking to? What is the situation like on the Mall, at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, at the places where Americans go to really think about what's happening in the world right now?
Yeah, well, I took a little trip down to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial yesterday, John, because it's a good place to go at a time when Americans are thinking about war and cost and opportunity. You know, I want to set the scene for you just to give you a sense of how people tend to think about things around the memorial there. I was hanging around a group of Korean War vets, just kind of talking to them, chatting, and up came a kid, an eighth grader named Joshua. Just listen.
Excuse me, have all you guys served the military?
And yeah.
Shake your hand.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you for your
Thank
service.
You. All right.
John?
What?
This little gentleman would like to shake your hand.
Oh!
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
You get old enough to Thank get you. Up there, why join the Marine Corps?
You know, that iconic V there in the middle of the mall is a place where civilians and military veterans meet and express those feelings of thank you and also sort of stare at the names on that wall if they're part of the Vietnam conflict and wonder what it was all for. And that's definitely a question that's being asked and answered by Americans today.
Yeah, there's no question about it. When they think about wars of the past in context of the war in Iraq and what might be ahead of policymakers here. John, I ran into a lot of Korean War vets yesterday. They were honor flight participants, not just World War II, but Korean War vets. And I fell into a conversation with a couple of guys, buddies from Clyde, Ohio, Glenn Kistler, who's a retired painter, and Gene Ross, a retired environmental engineer. And I sort of asked them what they hoped Americans were thinking about during this time of a renewed discussion about a crisis in Iraq.
I hope they're thinking we've had enough war. It's time to tell our representatives in Washington, Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter. Tell them that we're sick and tired of spending billions of dollars to help other countries that don't appreciate our help.
We spent $12 billion to train the Iraqi army. And what did they do? Threw their guns down and run. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Two Korean War veterans there, Glenn Kistler and Gene Ross. What else did they tell you?
Well, Gene Ross in particular, John, was very, very wary of any U.S. action going back into Iraq. Forget about troops on the ground, but even drone strikes. And a lot of the veterans I talked to, and I don't know if I just got a particular sample of them, it's impossible to tell, but they just really seemed pessimistic about the whole situation. Listen to Gene Ross and Glenn Kistler one more time here.
I do not feel that we should send American troops back to Iraq. I do not feel that we should send American planes back there. I don't feel that we should waste another dollar on Iraq. Let the Iraqi people take care of themselves. If they end up with a dictator, it's their country.
I hope from now on we're not the superpower. I hope somebody else leads. We're done leading. We've been leading forever. Let China send troops in there.
And I fell into another conversation with a really interesting woman, Melissa Diesberg. She's from around the neighborhood in Washington, Williamsburg, Virginia, not too far away. Melissa was there with her daughter, whose name was Victoria. And I had a great conversation with them that she steered around actually to the fact that she has a teenage son.
My son is 14, kind of looking at actually going into the service one day.
How does that make you feel?
Scared. with all these young men as early as 19. 20 coming home and have to be buried. So it's a scary thing for a mom. And with this whole thing in Iraq, it's scary.
You know, it's amazing, Todd, how these headlines and how the situation in Iraq right now, which policymakers are discussing in a very different context, should Nouri al-Maliki stay or go, is raising so many questions about what it means to serve the United States of America there in a place where so many people have served, and the evidence of it is on those walls.
No doubt about it. I'll leave you with this, though, John. Melissa said she would be proud to have her 14-year-old son join the military. But then I asked her to reflect on Iraq. Listen.
I know there's a lot of good people, and they're helping. But as far as us going over and giving as many lives as we've given, I just feel like maybe it wasn't worth it.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent on the Mall in Washington, D.C. We're going to take you on a journey now, a journey that began for thousands of children in the poor and politically unstable Central American countries of Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Children trying to reach their parents who have come to the United States for jobs and economic security with the idea that they would rejoin their children eventually. Well, some make it, some don't. But the ones that cross the U.S. border are sent to detention centers like the one in the border town of Nogales, Arizona. And after pressure from Congress, reporters were finally allowed to tour the Nogales Center yesterday. And among those reporters was Jude Joffe Block, senior field correspondent for member station KJZZ in Arizona. Jude, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm looking at some of these pictures here. Makeshift, it barely describes what you've got there. You've got kids behind chain link and bars and makeshift porta potties. There's even a big screen TV with a World Cup playing. What's it like to be in the midst of this detention center for hundreds of kids?
Well, it's really clear that this warehouse, I mean, it's a giant 120,000 square foot warehouse, was never designed to hold children. But I mean, they are trying to make it a place where children can spend a few days. Still, it was very difficult to see the conditions and see these children up close. Many of them looked very sad. We saw some kids who looked like they'd been crying. We walked by one of the holding pens because there are these kind of tall metal fence areas where they have children divided by age and gender. And we were standing outside of one that I think was housing boys who were around the age of 12. And most of them, when we walked up, were sleeping. They were laying on these mattresses on the floor with just these Mylar blankets, which are the kind that look like aluminum foil. But it was the middle of the day, and these are, you know, young boys. And that was, you know, that's certainly not, you know, a normal thing to see that many young children just kind of napping and dozing in the middle of the day.
And those aluminum foil looking blankets are just flimsy covering at best. Is there any sense of the average length of time that one of these young people stays in this detention facility?
Well, the Obama administration has said the goal is 72 hours. Actually, by statute, that's the law says it's supposed to be 72 hours too, though I guess realistically there have been some delays in that. But I think things have been, we know that some of the children have been processed through and are being processed through. They're going from this facility to usually to military bases that have been set up in Oklahoma, California, and Texas, that are a little bit more permanent of shelters, or they're going to shelters set up by the Office of Refugee Resettlement from this facility. So it's really supposed to be just a very short-term place for them.
One of the most remarkable things from your reporting is the extent to which Border Patrol agents and the people responsible for taking care of these young people are actually outraged at the ways in which this whole crisis has come about, really because of the intransigence in Washington. You spoke with Arthur Del Cueto, who's the president of the local Border Patrol Union.
You asked, where's the breaking point? I think the American public needs to realize that the breaking point is now. We need to transport these individuals back to the country of origin, El Salvador, Guatemala, or Honduras. That's where they're from. I don't think we need to release them in the United States.
So he's calling for mass deportation, which is just as complicated as reuniting them with their parents in the U.S., right?
Right. I mean, because, I mean, the thing is that some of these children might qualify for some kind of immigration relief. Some of them might have valid claims in terms of staying in this country. And so that's where things get complicated, because they do have a right to go before an immigration judge and make their case. The tricky thing is that we have such a backlog in the immigration court system that that's not a very speedy process. There's also the other issue, which a lot of these children might have difficulty getting legal counsel, and that might make it a lot harder for them to really make their case in court. But we have seen the Department of Justice with an initiative to try to get more volunteers and paralegals involved in legal services for these children. But what advocates are saying is that that's a welcome step, but it's really just a drop in the bucket given the volume.
Well, and given the volume and the extent to which translation is needed, facilities for attorneys to actually meet with clients. Jude Joffe Block, senior field correspondent for KJZZ in Arizona, who is one of the reporters allowed to tour the Nogales detention facility in Nogales, Arizona. Jude, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The raw numbers of unaccompanied minors arriving in U.S. detention centers is far from the end of the journey for these brave children. And the tens of thousands on their own are having to trust human traffickers called coyotes. A pipeline of children seeking their parents is flowing while the U.S. government fails to act on comprehensive immigration reform. Armando Truhl, a senior reporter from WAMU in Washington, D.C., brings us profiles of kids and parents just trying to be reunited against all odds. We begin with a child's solo journey and his mother Katia's prayer for his safety.
Katia is a housekeeper, and she works in one of the suburbs in Maryland, close into the District of Columbia. She'd been separated from her son for 6 years. Her son is 15 years old, and she'd been struggling to try to bring him over, had not been able to do so. And one day she gets a surprise call from her mother.
My mother surprised me when she told me he was no longer with her, that he has decided to come looking for me.
So Katia's son had decided on his own to basically make the journey to the United States. How old is he?
15. He's a ninth grader, and he basically had $500 that he had saved up over almost a year and a half, money that he had gotten from Katia, and he decided that that was going to be enough to make a 3,200-mile journey.
And here's Katia's reaction when she learns this from her mother.
I felt my hands and feet were tied. There's nothing you can do except ask God to protect your child. Pray for a miracle.
So Katia is praying, and all the time Katia is praying, little Mario is making his way slowly north to the United States. And here's a little bit of his story.
There's so much violence. I was even afraid to go to school. In El Salvador, many students on their way to school are disappearing.
And that speaks to his fear of being in his own community. Explain.
It's a fear that has gripped a lot of young people in not only El Salvador, where he is from, but also Guatemala and Honduras. The level of crime there is really, really off the charts. You've got a lot of gang activity, and Mario spoke very eloquently about how he would see his classmates disappear on their way to school, never to be seen again.
Well, certainly something that would motivate a child to run away from home or join the circus in the kind of playful mythology of the United States. But in this case, it's a 3,200-mile journey that, for Mario, ends up on the banks of the Rio Grande. Listen.
I crossed the river on a small raft, and knowing God was on my side, I wasn't scared. The only thing going through my mind was that all I was doing, God willing, was to make a better future for myself.
Mario eventually is reunited with his mother, right?
That's right. It took about 3 weeks. He was sent to a initial detention center by Homeland Security. From there, he had to be moved to a Health and Human Services approved youth facility. And then eventually his mother was contacted and told, "We have your son. You have to either pay to have him flown to Maryland, or you have to come pick him up." And she drove to get him. He was actually in Miami. That's where he wound up, at a Catholic youth center in Miami. She drove down there and was reunited with him.
Now, that's an example, Armando, of some young child who takes matters into his own hands. But there are many different pathways for getting from Central America to the United States, and you looked at a number of them.
Absolutely. That was one extreme where the child, as you said, decided to take the first step. For other parents, it's a very difficult decision. Now, I spoke to a woman called Elena. She is from Guatemala. She's a fast food worker, and she had also been separated from her children for 6 years. Her children are 13, 12, and 10 years old. And one of the problems that some of these parents have is that they've left their children with their grandparents. These grandparents are beginning to get old. And so as the violence escalates in Central America, as the economic conditions worsen, and as these caretakers become unable to take care of these children, those are some of the driving factors that press these parents into making desperate decisions, such as sending these children alone on a 3,000-mile journey and spending $12,000 to pay smugglers to do it. $12,000 is about 60%, 70% of this fast food worker's yearly salary.
And all the time, Elena has to rely on traffickers to basically take care of her three children. And here's Elena's sort of a description of the fears that she has doing this.
You know you're placing your children at risk by bringing them by themselves on this trip. I placed them in God's hands.
She told me, John, that she would get on her knees every night and pray for the safety of her three little children.
Well, the prayers, I gather, were answered, although no parent would want their children to go through this experience. Listen, these are Elena's children.
We had to climb a huge ladder. After we climbed the ladder, they lowered us on the other side.
I was scared and I was crying. I ran to the woods and sat down.
When you consider all of the terrible things that could have happened, these are the lucky ones, John. These are the ones who made it.
And so the dam is bursting. That's what we're seeing with this influx of people from Central America. Is that what you're saying, Armando?
Exactly. And I mean, the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area is home to about a third of the Central American population in the country. So you have a substantial number of immigrants here from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras. And so it's no surprise that they would eventually, a significant number of them, wind up here, because that's where the significant number of relatives or parents are.
And the immediate impacts are, of course, in the schools. Here's Stephanie Arameo, who counsels recently arrived immigrant students in Montgomery County High Schools.
Started off with 12 in October 2013, and now in May 2014, I ended with 26.
More than a 100% increase. Is that what you're seeing across the county?
I've spoken to several of the different jurisdictions in the Metro D.C. area, not just Montgomery County, but also in Prince George's, the District of Columbia, Virginia. And all of them have seen an increase. Some of them have seen that type of dramatic increase. Some of them have seen less. The problem is they don't really know how many children are going to ultimately come. And many of those children are coming here.
Armando Trull, senior reporter from WAMU, thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure to be here, John. Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Any journey from Central America to the United States means traversing more than 1,000 miles across a battlefield called Mexico. The Mexican drug wars, which prey on the powerless, which erode a nation of laws into a territory of warlords and drug chieftains who kill for the sake of killing and amass fortunes they can't even spend because they must remain in hiding. The warring cartels are driven in a strange and macabre way by the very same fantasy that propels young boys and girls to try and make it to the northern border in the United States. The cartels are driven by the promise of wealth and power that comes from the demand for drugs in the United States and the vast supply of guns and weapons in the country that is the number two on the list of top arms exporters in the world. In his new book, In the Shadow of Saint Death, author Michael Diebert shows us how the barbarity of the cartel wars in Mexico is born in the affluence and violence of the United States.
What had been somewhat isolated now is violence that's affecting everywhere in Mexico, practically, including places like Acapulco, including places like Cuernavaca in Morelos, which is very close to the capital and was the site of Malcolm Lowry's great novel, Under the Volcano. And so there has been, I'd say, a general disintegration of law and order in the country as a whole.
The depictions of violence here are, you know, many and varied. What explains the decapitations, the mass graves, the extent to which these murders are both symbol and just an expression of power?
Well, it's interesting because the gory video decapitations that have become kind of de rigueur for the narcos, they learned that basically by watching insurgent videos from Iraq. And it's just, you know, it's a way to terrorize people. But the mass graves are, I mean, it's a great testimony to the complete absence of the state in huge parts of Mexico. Because, I mean, when I was in Tamaulipas, at one point they were hauling out bodies of these people who had been kidnapped off buses and killed and buried, and they eventually got 193 bodies. And when they were interviewing some other Zetas that had been arrested, they said, oh, no, the number must be around 600. And it's like that in a lot of regions in Mexico. And this is why also it's very, very necessary to be very skeptical about the numbers connected to the drug war, because the terra firma of Mexico is full of mass graves. And, you know, the number of people that we have dead now, which including the missing, is somewhere around 70 to 75,000. Mm. I think it could be much, much more than that. And that makes the drug war in Mexico since 2006 the most deadly conflict in Latin America, aside from Guatemala's civil war, which was 30 years long and killed 200,000 people. But in the modern era, that's the most deadly.
One of the ironies is that, you know, the kind of Scarface romanticism of, you know, living in a life of luxury as an outlaw doesn't exist here. These people can't really have much freedom or much ability to enjoy whatever it is that they're winning, and it's just such an inhuman existence on both sides.
Yeah, and I started with one of the epigraphs of my book. One is from Octavio Paz, and the other is from a former hitman for the Zetas, and he says, you can have everything, but it has a price. And that's, I think, in some ways, the motif that runs through the existence of these guys. You can have all of this, you know, wealth and grandeur comparatively to growing up as some poor soldier or something like that. But it comes at a price. And it's also come with this whole now, this cultural, I would say, shift in Mexico of like the narcocorridos, which are these songs that glorify the drug trade in Mexico. I mean,
it's a whole genre of music. Yeah.
And there's a guy, I mean, El Comandar, who's a narcocorrido singer from Sinaloa, which is the birthplace of Mexican drug trafficking in a lot of ways, along with Tamaulipas. And, you know, he's one of the biggest stars in Mexico.
And for Mexican leaders, projecting sovereignty is this almost sort of open joke. I mean, to speak to the president of the United States and the other sovereigns in the world, you know, President Calderon has to say something like, we've got control of most of the territory. But Mexicans hear that and they find it completely laughable because they know that it's not even remotely the case.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, the new government in Mexico, the Peña Nieto government, who's from the PRI, who was the party that ran Mexico for 70 years up until 2000, they have a great PR machine, and they're trying to project this image of, you know, the country is turning a corner when, in fact, in Tamaulipas last year, the murder rate went up 90%. And, you know, I think if you talk to your average Mexican, they don't feel any safer now than they did 4 years ago. And Felipe Calderón, who was Peña Nieto's predecessor, had something interesting to say once, which is he said, you know, it's not easy living next door to the world's biggest and richest drug addict, which is the United States. And I think that's accurate. That's something to ponder for us as Americans.
Addict to drugs and also to guns. Yeah. You write about how on July 15th, Miguel Treviño was greeted by a swooping military helicopter and a raid that the Mexican government said succeeded in capturing the dreaded Z-40 and his two henchmen without a shot being fired. Treviño's face, bloated and bruised, was quickly splashed across all media venues, with some wondering aloud if the arrest of the most feared man in the world meant that Mexico's long nightmare of violence might soon be over. But when Z-40 was found, he had in possession an AK-47 variant that was traced to a disreputable gun seller in a San Antonio suburb.
Yeah, and so many of these guns come from the United States, and that's something that people have to understand. There was one guy I read about in the book who, over the period of a couple months, bought over 100 assault rifles in Houston, many of which were found in different crime scenes around Mexico, including an attack on the state prosecutor's office in Acapulco that killed 7 people.
Michael Dybert, why should Americans care about this? Because it seems like among the bizarre phenomena of this violence and drug war is that it is so meticulously contained south of the border. I mean, we certainly can see evidence of it in border towns, but you cross the border and there's piles of dead bodies. You come back into the United States and you know, it's relatively unscathed.
Well, I would say, you know, there's piles of dead bodies in Chicago, in New Orleans, in Baltimore, in Miami. And I think, you know, the death and destruction that has been caused by the criminalization of narcotics in the United States and the perfect market environment that's been created for criminals by that criminalization is what really has to end, along with a more restrictive gun policy. I mean, I advocate in the book, I look at the example of Portugal, which decriminalized, you know, personal use amounts of drugs in 2000. And in 14 years, they have not had any great huge spike in drug use or drug abuse. And in fact, between 13 to 19-year-olds, the rate of use went down. And I don't think Americans can eternally kind of just watch Mexico go up in flames and claim they don't have a responsibility for it. Because with half the population of Europe, we consume more cocaine a year. I have the number in the book. It's several billion dollars worth of cocaine a year. So, you know, we're funding in every way this war. And also, our banks are laundering drug money. You know, the private prison industry in the United States is making huge amounts of money from imprisoning people, largely for narcotics-related offenses. There's no end to this. I mean, it happened in Colombia. It happened in happening in Mexico, Guatemala. Honduras is also a place that's being torn apart by drug violence related to drug trafficking, I should say. And, I mean, I really think that the states are leading the way in terms of looking at decriminalization as an option.
So you think legalization in Colorado and Washington State is the beginning of the end and the pathway out of this?
I really hope so.
Michael Dybert is author of In the Shadow of Saint Death, The Gulf Cartel and the Price of America's Drug War in Mexico. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Tomorrow on The Takeaway, is abortion the last comedy taboo? Conversation with actress Jenny Slate and director Gillian Robespierre about their new romantic comedy, Obvious Child. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia,
and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.